From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Growing Up in the Shadow of a Saint, we talk with Ken Wiwa about his new memoir. His father was the Nigerian writer and activist Ken Sarawiwa, who was executed by the Nigerian government in 1995. In the new memoir, Ken Wiwa tries to reconcile his father's martyrdom with the family's resentment of his activism, which left him little time to be a husband or father. Also today, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the old and new euphemisms for economic hard times. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Michigan Democrat David Bonier says he's stepping down in January as minority House whip. A battle is already underway to succeed him. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
David Bonier has served as the second highest-ranking Democrat in the House for exactly 10 years, but he announced he's leaving that post January 15th to concentrate on his bid to become the Democratic candidate for governor in Michigan. The state's current governor, Republican John Engler, cannot be reelected due to term limits. Bonier has served in the House for 26 years. He's had the support of organized labor and has been a strong foe of trade deals. Two other House Democrats are battling to be Bonier's successor. Should Nancy Pelosi of California win, she would be the first woman ever to serve in a leadership position in the U.S. Congress. Pelosi claims to have a few more supporters than her rival, Steny Hoyer of Maryland. Bonier did not say which of them he'll support when House Democrats choose a new whip sometime this fall. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Associated Press quotes a Republican source saying Elizabeth Dole will announce tomorrow that she will run for the Senate seat being vacated by Jesse Helms. Dole is expected to make the announcement at her hometown of Salisbury. Elizabeth Dole has not lived in North Carolina in decades and had long been registered to vote in her husband's home state of Kansas. A California businessman pardoned by former President Clinton for fraud has taken the Fifth Amendment during an appearance before a Senate committee. A. Glenn Braswell refused to answer any questions put to him by a Senate Aging Committee chairman, John Breaux. The hearing focused on how senior citizens are swindled by dietary supplements that cannot and do not live up to their claims. Jurors in West Virginia heard opening arguments today in the nation's first case, which demands that tobacco companies pay for medical testing for healthy smokers. Jeff Young of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
Plaintiff's attorney Scott Siegel told jurors tobacco companies could have made cigarettes less likely to cause disease, but instead made a defective product. Siegel says the companies should pay for medical monitoring, even though his clients knew smoking was risky.
What people don't know until they see the documents is that they knew how to make safer cigarettes. They knew how to fix this problem, and they failed to do it.
Attorneys for the tobacco companies say while cigarettes may be dangerous, they are not defective. They also argue that medical monitoring will not benefit smokers. Plaintiffs could number a 250,000 people in the case. Testimony could last through November. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Young in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Stock prices were mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down less than a point at 96.05. There were about 2 billion shares that traded hands. Losing shares outnumbered the winners 2-1. The Nasdaq was up 7 points at 16.95, and the S&P 500 closed up 7 to 10.92. This is NPR News. The pharmacist who successfully sued her employer to win health insurance coverage for birth control told lawmakers that federal legislation is still needed. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Jennifer Erickson sued her firm, the retail pharmacy chain Bartell Drug Company, for sex discrimination for its failure to pay for her birth control pills. In June, a federal judge agreed that the policy violated the Federal Civil Rights Act. That decision followed a similar ruling last December by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. But backers of a federal bill that would require insurers to cover prescription contraception if they cover other prescription drugs told a Senate hearing that the decisions don't go far enough. That's because they don't cover millions of women who buy their own policies or employers with fewer than 15 workers. But the bill has opposition from the business community, which says it could raise insurance premiums, and from religious groups who say some forms of contraception violate their beliefs. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
A mass murder suspect committed suicide today after a gun battle with police in Sacramento, California. A California Highway Patrol officer and a bystander were injured during the police chase with Joseph Ferguson. Ferguson is a former security guard accused of killing five people. Ferguson killed himself after leading police on a wild 40-minute chase in a stolen car early today. Secretary of State Colin Powell is headed to Latin America to expand U.S. ties in the region beyond Mexico. Leading up to the trip, the Bush administration designated a right-wing Colombian group as a terrorist organization and banned financial support for it. Powell says the United Self-Defense Forces is responsible for the massacre of hundreds of civilians and that it aims to terrorize and intimidate local populations. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Siemens, providing products and technology solutions for energy, healthcare, communications, transportation, and industry. On the web at usa.siemens.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new memoir titled In the Shadow of a Saint, my guest Ken Wiwa writes about being the son of a man who was a hero to his people and became a martyr. Wiwa's father, Ken Sara Wiwa, was best known in his country, Nigeria, as a fearless newspaper columnist, the author of about 25 books, the writer of a popular sitcom, and an environmental activist who led his people, the Ogoni people, to protest the impact of Shell oil on their land. In 1995, Ken Sara Wiwa was executed by the military dictatorship. He was hanged along with eight other Ogoni activists. Ken Wiwa was 26 years old when his father was executed. He was living in Canada, beginning his career as a journalist. He now writes for the Toronto Globe and Mail. Although his father was a public hero, he wasn't always a hero at home. Wiwa sometimes resented his father's activism, which interfered with his role as a father.
As a family, you were aware that what he was doing was for the good of the people, and that was we didn't resent that as such. But it was when the activism in itself became impinged on the family life that's when we really felt, you know, we resented it, if you like. Primarily, you know, when my youngest brother died very suddenly of a heart attack, you know, we sort of felt that perhaps it was something to do with his campaign against the military, that there was something suspicious about my brother's death. So when that begins to happen, you begin to get a sense that, well, perhaps is this worth all the trouble that, you know, his family has been threatened because of his political conscience.
Was there any truth behind that fear? You know, the fear that possibly the military or the government was behind your brother's death?
No, I mean, you know, he died of a heart attack. He was 14 years old, and he died very suddenly. And it just so happened it was at a time when my father was beginning to attract a lot of attention, both from the military. So it's just a juxtaposition of the timing of his death that made, you know, when something like that happens in a family, you look for reasons. And often it's not very, you know, you're very emotional and not very rational, and all kinds of things come into play. And I guess when there's sort of underlying resentment about your father's activism, it's easy to make the connections at that particular time. But, you know, with hindsight and a little bit of distance from those occasions, then perhaps, you know, the two weren't linked. But, you know, one could never know.
You write that you were so hostile to your father at home, you thought that he might have been seeking refuge in the unquestioned adulation he received as the father of his people, the Ogoni people.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, you know, after my father was executed, I mean, I felt guilty that perhaps I was somehow responsible for pushing him into his political activism. Because, of course, when he did come home, I kind of made his absence felt, made him feel guilty for not being around as a father and as a husband.
When you say you were hostile to your father at home, how did you express that hostility?
Well, I mean, I think specifically, again, going back to when my youngest brother, Didim, was died in 1993, at that point, you know, my father, the campaign was really coming to the boil back at home in Nigeria. At this time, we were in England. My brother died in England. Of course, he had to leave behind what was happening in Nigeria to fly over to England for the funeral. And I made it very clear to me it seemed that he couldn't wait to bury his son and then rush back to Nigeria. And I made my feelings clear to him. I mean, it wasn't explicit, but I think he was aware that throughout the whole burial, the funeral, my brother's funeral, that I was watching him and feeling fairly hostile towards him and wishing that perhaps, you know, that he stuck around to comfort the family. Because, you know, we were all devastated at that point that something could happen to, you know, my youngest brother was almost the center of the family, very bright, very intelligent young man, and we were absolutely devastated that, you know, he could just suddenly drop dead of a heart attack at 14. But my father didn't stick around for long enough to do what you would expect a father would do, because he had just as important matters to deal with in Nigeria.
Meanwhile, you spent a lot of your formative years in England, where your father sent you to study. Why did he want you to study in England?
Well, I think he had grown up when Nigeria was still a British colony, and he'd been sent to a colonial public school, private school, if you like, and he'd received a classical English education. But by the time his children were ready to be educated, those kinds of schools were no longer available because the wherewithal of our system, they'd run down the good schools we'd inherited from the British colonialists. So he decided to send his children abroad to England to get the same kind of standard of education that he'd received as a boy. And really, you know, he did that because he wanted us to acquire a first-class education so that we would come back to Nigeria and sort of apply our minds, our well-trained minds, to the problems facing our people.
Was it your intention to go back to Nigeria?
Well, you know, I left Nigeria. I was 10 years old when I left, and by the time I'd finished my education, I was arguably more British, more English than I was Nigerian. I mean, I have this dual personality. I have the African personality and identity, but I also have this English identity. So my loyalties were really divided and torn. And by the time, you know, I'd finished my education, I was slightly more conflicted about this idea of returning back to Nigeria. And I looked around and I saw most of the friends I'd grown up with in Nigeria were desperate to get out of a country which offered them no opportunities whatsoever. And so I didn't see that. I didn't feel that there was anything in Nigeria that could offer me, a halfway decent life. However, my father felt that, well, the struggle was something that I needed to come back to. So, so having been sort of determinedly apolitical for most of my teenage years, my father was offering me a political life to come back to in Africa. So, of course, you know, it was a difficult choice for me to make.
Mm-hmm. Is part of what you were feeling about your father just the pressure of having to live up to his image as someone who was an opponent of the military regime, an environmental activist, an advocate for his people, a satirist with a popular TV sitcom? I mean, he was pretty successful. Is that part of the problem, that you felt like you had to live up to this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, my father was a great man and a very successful man in many fields. I was his first son and his namesake. And of course, there were expectations that I would follow in his footsteps. And wherever I went, you know, I imagined that people were comparing me to him. And I still imagine people always say, well, you know, his father did this. What's so special about his son? Has he got this? Is he made of the same stuff?
Being compared to your father and being his namesake was such an issue for you that you actually changed your name. Your name was Ken Sarawiwa. Sara means son of. You took out the Sara.
Sara means the first son. Yeah, I mean, I just dropped the Sara to be Ken Wiwa, merely to distinguish myself from him. Very practical thing as well, because I was a journalist in England and I also wrote for Nigerian newspapers. And I didn't particularly want to be Ken Sarawiwa Jr. I just wanted to try to make a name for myself. Mm-hmm. Just try to tell people that, you know, I had things to offer as an individual, regardless of who my father was. I mean, most people don't go around, you know, if you're John Wilson, you know, nobody says you're the son of John Wilson. And nobody imagines it. Whereas if I was Ken Saro-Wiwa, immediately people would bring preconceived notions or assumptions or whatever. So I just wanted people to take me at face value. It's always a double-edged sword when you carry a famous name because, you know, on one hand it opens doors, but on the other hand, you carry a sort of a weight of expectation which is often unwarranted.
My guest is Ken Wiwa. His new memoir is called In the Shadow of a Saint. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Wiwa. He has written a memoir called In the Shadow of a Saint, A Son's Journey to Understand His Father's Legacy. His father was Ken Saro-Wiwa, a Nigerian environmental activist, tribal activist, and anti-government activist who was executed by the Nigerian government in 1995. He was hanged. Your father was arrested several times for his activism. The final time he was arrested, you didn't realize it was the final time and that he was soon to be executed. You wrote to him complaining that his life had restricted your choices. In what way did you perceive that, you know, that his life had restricted your choices?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, at the time what was happening was that he was insisting that I give up my job to travel around the world raising awareness of his predicament. Now, you know, he'd been arrested a number of times and we'd come to sort of expect that was a pattern. And each time he would be released, you know, he'd be arrested for a day, 2 days, a month, and then he would be released. So, you know, if you're, you know, it's easy with hindsight to see what had happened. But I mean, at the time, he's arrested. Here I am working at a job as a journalist, and what do you do? Do you give up your work to go and live, you know, to go and spend your life campaigning for your father? How do you meet your rent? How do you pay your bills? Because it's not a paying job. What happens if he's released, you know, in 2 weeks' time? Then you have to go back to work, and then if he's arrested again, do you give up your job? So, you know, it's a question of what I was saying to him, you know, is it that every time that something happens to you, I have to drop my life for you? So, you know, that was the dilemma that I faced in 1994 when I heard he'd been arrested again. And that's what I mean by saying that his life was always dictating my choices, my responses, because of his political activism. I was, you know, I had to change my name. To try and carve out, you know, my own identity, and so, you know, when I wrote to him, he said, that's when he said, it's a pity that children can't choose their parents.
How honest was he with you when he wrote you letters from prison about how he was being treated? For instance, he was being tortured. Did he let you know that?
No, he didn't. I mean, that was a curious thing. It was that, you know, in the subtext of all of this, we were writing quite tough letters to each other. But I was sort of, at the back of my mind, I was aware that, of course, you know, the conditions he was under the circumstances, I perhaps had no right to be saying some of the things I was saying. But at the same time, he was responding in a very generous and warm way, which in the end enabled us to make the connections as father and son that we hadn't made for 10, 15 years. And we were beginning to actually repair our relationship. And, you know, halfway through it, there was a sort of a tacit agreement between us to kind of put that to one side. I was going to go out, give up my job and the campaign to save his life. And then we would pick up the thread of our discussions after he was released. Of course, the hangman cut short our reconciliation. So in a sense, when I came to write this book, I really wanted to pick up that process of the reconciliation, the attempts at reconciling our differences.
So what did you do before your father's execution to try to save him?
Well, I traveled around the world, you know. I spoke at schools, at universities. I wrote editorials in newspapers. I lobbied governments, NGOs, you know, and I collected awards on his behalf. Really all the things that you can try to do once a man becomes a human rights hostage, as it were, which in effect is what he was. And, you know, we were trying to build the pressure against the Nigerian government, build an international coalition, raise public opinion and awareness of what was happening. And also at the same time, really to spread the word about what was happening to our people, because it wasn't just about Ken Saro-Wiwa, it was about the Ogoni people. Yes, Ken Saro-Wiwa was a representative of what was happening to the Ogoni people. But, you know, always, my father always made sure that I was aware that it wasn't about him. It was also about campaigning on behalf of the Ogoni people.
So when you were traveling around the country campaigning on your father's behalf, did you lose your apartment because you couldn't meet the rent, or did you lose your job?
No, I gave up my job, and you know, I was supported by my girlfriend and by my father. So, you know, it was like a very curious thing that, you know, in a sense, I was growing into myself as an activist, as a man who was, I felt good about myself because I was doing something not just for my father but for my people. I was bringing our people's plight to the awareness of Americans, of Germans, of Irish people, British people. But at the same time, I felt myself being diminished in a way that, you know, I wasn't being able to take care of the things I should have been taking care of. You know, I was 25 years old, and you know, you live this kind of scrambled existence where you're doing good things, but you know, you're having to be supported to do the good things. So it's a curious kind of way of being.
When you were traveling around before your father was executed, traveling in the hopes of saving him, you say the experience increased your cynicism about politics. You write, "I thought I had found every reason to loathe politics and politicians, but I found some new ones during the last week of my father's life." Like what?
Well, you know, it's just the way, I mean, as I describe in the book, the deceptions that I came across. You know, there was I. My father had been sentenced to death. I was in New Zealand at the Commonwealth Conference, and I was lobbying prime ministers and presidents, trying to tell them, look, you know, you must send out a concerted statement to General Abacha, the Nigeria's military leader at the time, that he must not execute Ken Saro-Wiwa. Now, you know, in every meeting I went to, you know, they heard what I was saying, and then, you know, and then they did nothing. And I realized that actually what they were doing was that they were being seen to be doing something, i.e. meeting the son of the imprisoned writer. But when I left the room, they would go behind closed doors and they would sit around and discuss the implications and other factors above the inhumanity and the injustice of what was happening to the man would come into play. i.e. they didn't want to upset a giant multinational, didn't want to upset a valued military regime. So I realized that politicians, you know, in a sense I grew up, I lost my innocence, and the politicians work to a consensus, and often that consensus, if that consensus means an innocent man is, they do nothing whilst an innocent man is hanged, then that's what they will do. I mean, And that's what I came to realize is what politics is about. It's about this kind of making these kind of horse trading and playoffs, and I find that very disquieting because of course you know I was involved in something which for me had a moral weight that was more important than, you know, the maintaining the political status quo. But you know, that's the way of the world.
What happened the night of your father's execution, to the best of your understanding?
Well, it was a night for me, but it was because I was in New Zealand. But it was obviously mid afternoon for my father. But I remember I just had a meeting with the Canadian Prime Minister, and I came out and we'd heard that the day before or a few hours before we'd heard that executioners had gone to the prison to carry out the executions, but have been turned back because they didn't have the right paperwork. But they were going to come back in a few hours. So we realized that that unless the politicians did something, it was, you know, my father would be executed. So there was this sort of frantic few hours of running around, holding press conferences, trying to meet people like President Mandela and the British Prime Minister to try and get them to make the statement, to make the call to General Abacha. We were trying to get President Clinton to call General Abacha. And so once I'd had this meeting with the Prime Minister of Canada, I just felt that perhaps I'd done everything I could, and now it was in the lap of the gods. And so I went off to sort of do one more interview for the BBC breakfast program, and I did that. And then I went to supper with some friends who had been helping me coordinate sort of my media appearances and my meetings with the politicians. And so we just had a sort of a farewell dinner, I suppose, because I'd already announced that, you know, I think I'd done enough. I was going to leave and go back to London to be with my mother and my brothers and sisters to wait to see what would happen. And around sort of midnight of that dinner, I sort of felt this tugging sensation in my chest, as if my heart had just been ripped apart. And I didn't really think too much of it. And I suppose I went to bed that night, and I couldn't really sleep. And I heard there was a lot of commotion in the corridors. And in the morning, you know, my friend came in and told me the news. But when I later sort of read the eyewitness account of his hanging, and it had a very detailed account of it with times and when everything was happening. I think he was actually hanged at about midday in Nigeria, which was exactly the same time, which was midnight in New Zealand, which equates to the time when I had that wrenching feeling in my heart.
What did you learn about the hanging and what was done with your father's body after?
Well, you know, had this eyewitness account, which, you know, which I've sort of written about in the book there, but you know, we've been told various things, that acid was poured on his remains, and he was buried in a pit with the other eight who were hanged along with him. To this day, we still don't know, because the authorities, even though we now have a civilian government in Nigeria, they still won't tell us what happened to my father.
Ken Wiwa. His new memoir is called In the Shadow of a Saint. Wiwa is a journalist who writes for the Toronto Globe and Mail. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ken Wiwa tells us how his life was changed by his father's execution. Also, economists are talking about a possible recession. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers old and new euphemisms for economic hard times. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ken Wiwa. His new memoir, In the Shadow of a Saint, is about being the son of a martyr. His father, Ken Sara Wiwa, was a Nigerian newspaper columnist and environmental activist who was executed by the Nigerian government in 1995. Ken Wiwa was 26 at the time of the execution. He was living in Canada, beginning his career as a journalist. He didn't want to follow in his father's footsteps. He was disillusioned with politics and with the impact that being a public hero had on the family. After your father was executed, everyone was saying to you, your father can't have died in vain. What did people expect you to do? What did you think you should do to make sure that that death wasn't in vain?
Well, I mean, the world was outraged, and you know, the news was it was headline news around the world, and everybody was commenting on it, and really, you know, I was swept along this sort of on this tidal wave of emotion and disgust and outrage, and I suppose I was swept along into more meetings I met Boutros Ghali, who was the Secretary General of the UN at the time. I met various other politicians, and I had more press conferences, and so on and so forth. I suppose the idea was to isolate the military regime, to try and get sanctions against the Nigerian regime, to punish them for carrying out these executions. But you know, after a while, these meetings with politicians I got bogged down in it, and at some point I realized, look, my father is dead. I have to come to terms with that. The politics of this will be dealt with. Somebody else needs to deal with the politics of this, because you can't carry on doing, you know, carry on sort of working and doing all the things you're trying to do when your father's been hanged. And you know, you have to come to terms with that. And I think that's why I decided to stop being the public face of the Ogoni cause, and try to deal with my own private emotions and the things that, you know, the fact that my father was dead.
One of the things that you did was to travel to other parts of the world to meet other children of famous activists and see how they had dealt with that. What are some of the things you learned from those experiences?
Well, I think, you know, when my father died, you know, after he was executed, I was wrestling with a whole bunch of confusing, conflicting emotions. On the one hand, I was very proud of my father. On the other hand, I was very angry with him for having left me with this sort of huge political legacy, as well as his own personal legacies, which I was struggling to deal with. And then I also felt guilty, like I said earlier, that perhaps I'd pushed him out of the home and into the struggle. I also felt guilty that perhaps I hadn't done enough to save his life, that I hadn't worked hard enough to save him. And then I felt guilty that that when he died, I didn't really feel any emotion. You know, I didn't cry. I didn't feel the things you're supposed to feel when your father dies. And so I had all these conflicting, contradictory emotions. Perhaps, you know, I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown, and I thought there was something wrong with me for having all these different emotions and so on and so forth. So when I went out to meet people like Zinzi Mandela and Kozinati Biko, who's the son of Steve Biko. And it was only when I talked to them that I realized that, yes, they had been through the same conflicts too, so there wasn't something wrong with me. It was perfectly normal to feel these contradictions, because when you have a father who's is a political figure, there are complexities of it which other people don't appreciate, because you know they don't have that biological emotional tie, but when you do that, you do have these complex emotions, and so you know, in a sense, meeting someone like Kozinati Biko was like meeting a kindred spirit, like a brother in a sense. You know, as I said, when we were talking, we were finishing each other's thoughts because we were on the same wavelength, and we understood each other. And he understood what I was going through, and he'd been through it with his father, and he'd managed to sort out all the emotions too. So in a sense, he was giving me the benefit of his experience, and I realized that, you know, with time, I would come to terms with all these conflicting emotions. I would be able to sort through all the things I was feeling or not, or was trying to feel about my father. And so that, all those conversations helped me, you know, come to terms with it.
Do you feel like you're in a different place emotionally now than you were when your father was alive or shortly after he was executed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, right now, you know, I still have the respect for my father, but I've also been able to find the love that I once had for my father. You know, when I was a young boy, my father meant everything to me. I loved him unreservedly. And, you know, over time, we sort of lost that. But now I think I found that love again. But, you know, the most painful thing is not being able to say that to him, to sit him down and say, look, you know, now I understand why you were doing those things. I understand why you weren't available for us. I forgive you, and I hope you forgive me. And at the end of the book, I write a posthumous letter to him. And it is my way of saying sorry, and it was also a love letter to my father. And you know, and I have children myself, and it's a source of real pain that my grandchildren will never see their grandfather, that great man. And you know, when you have grandchildren, I guess what you do is you compensate for the things you couldn't give your own children. And I suppose that would have helped him himself too to come to terms with, you know, because he felt pain that he couldn't give his children the kind of emotional support that other fathers can perhaps give their children. But perhaps, you know, seeing his grandchildren doing that would have compensated for that and would have helped settle his own pain.
So what got you to change? What got you to see things more from your father's perspective? And I mean, to understand his motivations better than you did when you were younger?
It's writing the book, you know. I mean, it's a process of maturity. It's reading about Nelson Mandela, meeting Zindzi Mandela, meeting Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, becoming a father myself, and understanding that, you know, that your children compete. You know, there are so many things that compete for your attention with your children. You know, it's just a process of becoming older and becoming wiser. And I mean, it's a process we all go through. You know, we all want the relationship we had with our parents as children. But of course, you know, over time that changes and it changes again. It's the arc of a human relationship.
Do you think your father would have approved of you being so honest? A lot of parents have the kind of attitude like, don't hang our dirty laundry in public.
My father was a searingly honest, you know, the truth was, I mean, he fought injustice with truth. And a lot of people who knew him say he would have read this book and laughed. And I was a bit taken aback by that when I first heard that. But then I realized, looking at my father, is that he was a man who, although he fought very serious issues, he was a man with a tremendous sense of humor. He was always laughing. And he enjoyed a good debate. He enjoyed a good argument. And he would have been happy to engage with this. I mean, he may have said, "Oh, that's a load of nonsense" or whatever. But you know, in the end, for him, life is about debates. It's about exchange of opinions. It's about communicating. And the sadness for him was that when he offered a way forward, a vision for his people and for Nigeria, you know, the small-minded people who run our country, run my country, felt so threatened by what he was saying that they had to execute him.
My guest is Ken Wiwa. His new memoir is called In the Shadow of a Saint. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ken Wiwa, son of the executed Nigerian activist Ken Sara Wiwa. Ken Wiwa's new memoir is called In the Shadow of a Saint. When you were going to college in England, you didn't really want to return home to Nigeria. You wanted to stay in England because you liked your life there, and there weren't many opportunities in Nigeria. Now that you have two children who are growing up in Canada, do you feel strongly like, well, you have to at some point take them to Nigeria so they know something about the country that you're from?
Yeah, well, I've taken them back to Nigeria already, and you know they're going to be aware of where they came from, and perhaps even more than I am, because in a curious way, some of these things may skip a generation.
I know what you mean.
So, you know, in my sort of ambivalence towards Africa, they may have a yearning for Africa.
Right.
So
I'm
aware
handle
of that.
I mean, you can accept that things skip a generation and.
Sure, sure. I mean, that's why I wrote this book. So they have a, you know, I didn't want them to grow up with a romanticized version of Ken Sara Wiwa, their grandfather. I didn't want them to read all the nonsense that's been written about their grandfather and then come to me and say, is this true or whatever? And say, well, look, read this book and you'll have a much better sense of who your grandfather was. A man of magnificent complexity and contradictions, but a brave and courageous man at the same time. And, you know, the world is a complex place, and my relationship with Africa, I mean, wherever I am, I take Africa with me. And I continue to promote Africa, continue to promote Nigeria and the Goni people to hope for a better future for our people. And, you know, and one day maybe I may even live there permanently. I mean, I go back every 3 months because I have to. I still have my father's businesses to run and deal with, and I still have family there. So I've become the head of the family. So Africa is still in me, and it's still very much a part of me. But you know, what's interesting is that I remember once watching a documentary about the lions of on the Serengeti in East Africa, and it says that when the lions, they have these cubs, and when their cubs are old enough, the parents chase the cubs away, and the cubs wander around the Serengeti until they're ready to settle down and establish a pride of their own. But each time a lion is about to die, it always goes back to the place where it was born to die.
Interesting. But, yeah.
But you know, and when you think about that, yes, it's a bit like the human journey, as it were, from birth to death. But at the same time, it has an implication for our sense of home, because every succeeding generation has a different place of home. Home is a different place. So one lion moves to another place, establishes a place of home. But he goes back to die, but his own children will go somewhere else and establish their home and then come back to another home, but it's not the original home. So, you know, perhaps we're humans are born to migrate, to move, to take their home with them and recreate new homes, which becomes the sort of, you know, the idea of home for the next generation. But the generation after that has a different place to call home. So perhaps my children will have that too, you know, maybe. For me, home, the place called home, is a very particular place in Africa. But for my children, home, the place they call home, maybe may not be the same place I think of as home.
In your memoir, you write, one of the toughest things about death is finding a balance between forgetting and remembering. And has that balance shifted for you? I mean, are there different things that you want to forget and remember now than you thought you wanted to forget and remember right after your father died?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it does change. Yeah, you're absolutely right there. I mean, I hadn't really thought about that. But yeah, there are, I want to remember different things. So right now, I want to, you know, I remember my father, all the times we smiled, all the times we enjoyed together, enjoyed each other's company. I actively seek out the positive things that I remember, my relationship with my father and the positive things about him. Often, you know, there are other things which crop up from time to time. You know, my father had children with other wives, other women, and that causes me an immense amount of stress sometimes. But you know, I choose to go beyond that anxiety and the anger that I feel that he created for me, and just remember that, you know, that he made his choices and he lived with it. And what I must try and do is to try and help him. But, you know, in the end, what I try to do is try to remember the good things, because it helps you to solve the problems.
I'd like to end with asking you to read a letter that your father wrote you from prison. And would you explain when he wrote this and what you were doing when you received it?
This is at the time when I'm still wrestling with what I want to do with my life. You know, I'm living in England. He's in detention, and I'm still struggling to sort of find my place in the world. And he writes back and he says, "Look, it's not, you know, he's trying to give me some advice. He's in detention at the time, and he's trying to give me advice about, you know, how to tackle this issue, which all of us all feel. You know, how do you find your place in the world? What do you want to do with your life?" And, you know, these words have become engraved in my mind, and I keep it up in my study, and I always remember that this is the last piece of advice which my father gave me, and I hold on to it very dearly. And so he writes, "Knowing what you want out of life is the real thing. Once you are clear, you can work towards it and make alterations where necessary. You must have ambitions, goals. I don't see you with your education scratching around the fringes of British society. You should use the advantages which your British experience has offered you to promote your African and Ogoniness. And don't feel intimidated by my success. I do not demand, will never demand the same of you. I repeat, I'm not trying to build a dynasty. If you can be yourself, if you can be a success in a little way, in one little field, you will have satisfied me. I cannot recommend the sort of life I've lived to any of my children. It's been too dizzying, too controversial, but it was my destiny. I hope you relax, build a good family, and help our people when you can. But always write. You have a good style."
I love, you do have a good style. It's a very well-written book. And it's interesting, you know, that he gives you that advice, you know, write. Little did he know that what you wrote would be a memoir about him. I mean, you also are a journalist and you write all the time. But, I mean, right. Little did he know that your first book would be this memoir about him.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps knowing my father, he probably hoped I would write about him too. But, you know, I think that's become my destiny, I sense, you know, to tell his story and history and to tell our story.
It's funny, that letter kind of lets you off the hook. You know, it says, "I don't expect you to live my life. I don't expect you to, don't feel pressured to be successful. I don't recommend my life to you. Find your own destiny."
Yeah, it releases me in one sense, but in the other sense, in another way, by saying I should write, it was a challenge. You know, I had to write something, because that was the least he expected of me. I mean, okay, fine, I don't have to do the same as him, but I have to write, which meant I had to write.
But you weren't going to do that anyways?
Well, perhaps I was going to do that anyway. I mean, it was always, you know, I was a journalist already, so it was the obvious thing that was my destiny to be a writer. But it was also a challenge to write a book about what had happened. And, you know, I felt that very keenly, even after his exit. I realized that I had to write something. But even beyond that, having written something, I still feel, well, what good is a book? Is this book going to deliver water, education, electricity, hospitals, decent schools to our people? You know, I can sit here for the rest of my life and write 100 books. If it doesn't deliver our people from their hell, their suffering, what good is that? So, you know, the writing in itself is, it may not be enough, you know, it may... You know, this is something I'm going to have to wrestle with for the rest of my life.
So what you're wrestling with, in a way, is if you should become the kind of activist your father was.
Well, this is, you know, in a curious way, this is what my father, you know, my father wrote 50 books, numbers of articles. He wrote a sitcom watched by 30 million people, but nothing changed. He decided to give up writing and take the word to the streets. And when he did, he was able to finally mobilize our people to stand up and protest against their injustice of their situation. Now, for me, knowing what happened and knowing what happened to my father, there's a curious thing that, you know, there's a satisfaction in having written, but there's also a very, very strong dissatisfaction in that it hasn't changed anything at home either. So, you know, I'm going to have to wrestle with this too.
Right. Well, Ken Wiwa, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Ken Wewa has written a new memoir called In the Shadow of a Saint. He lives in Canada and writes for the Toronto Globe and Mail. Coming up, as the economy falters, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers old and new euphemisms for hard times. This is Fresh Air. A lot of people breathed a sigh of relief when the Commerce Department recently announced that the gross domestic product for the second quarter of 2001 had grown by 0.2%. According to a widely used definition, that means that the U.S. economy didn't satisfy the technical definition of a recession. As our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, it's just one more sign of the influence that economists have on the way we talk about hard times nowadays.
I got a job working construction for the Johnstown Company, but lately there ain't been much work on account of the economy.
That's Bruce Springsteen's The River, one of his chronicles of working class desperation. The sentiment wouldn't be out of place in a song by Woody Guthrie, but Guthrie wouldn't have talked about the economy. He would have said, "There ain't been much work on account of times are hard." It's only in the last 40 years or so that ordinary people have talked about the economy like that, as a natural force that blows hot and cold like the weather. As time goes by, we turn to economists more and more for help in talking about the vagaries of fortune, particularly when times are bad. It began with the word depression itself. Economists since Adam Smith used phrases like trade depression, but only in a literal sense, to mean that prices or production were lowered. The word didn't acquire its modern sense until after the stock market crash of 1893, which was triggered by the overbuilding of railroad infrastructure. The general economic meltdown that followed became known as the Depression of the 90s. Before it was over, a third of the nation's railroads were in bankruptcy. President Cleveland and his party had been roundly repudiated in midterm elections, and the word depression was irredeemably associated with desperate times. Not long after that, economists introduced the word recession as a new euphemism for economic reverse. Just a few weeks after the Wall Street crash of October 1929, The Economist magazine confidently reassured its readers that American prosperity was too firmly based to risk a prolonged slowdown, even if we have to face an immediate recession of some magnitude. But as the collapse got worse, the delicacy of describing it as a recession became more and more incongruous. As the narrator of a 1938 Eric Ambler thriller put it, "Trade recession, they called it. As far as I could see, there wasn't a great deal of difference between a trade recession and a good old-fashioned slump." Euphemisms tend to lose their usefulness when their cover gets threadbare, and by all rights, recession should have suffered the same fate that depression had. But by the second half of the 20th century, economists had enough public influence to reclaim the word. About 40 years ago, the Kennedy administration economist Arthur Okun suggested that a recession should be defined as a period of two consecutive quarters of decline in gross domestic product. The definition was simple and convenient, and it caught on quickly with the press. By now, it's even worked its way into some dictionaries. Still, that definition could fail to capture some serious slumps, and a lot of economists don't use it. Some of them define a recession in terms of the unemployment rate or other factors, and others refuse to give any precise criteria at all. In fact, the Federal Reserve Bank defines a recession simply as a significant decline in general economic activity extending over a period of time. Of course, you'd expect a certain amount of vagueness from an institution that's made a high art of not tipping its hand. But when you pin them down over drinks, most economists will admit that a recession is really no more exact a notion than a bad hair day. Even so, that technical definition of recession is attractive to politicians who are mindful of what happened to President Cleveland. Back in the early 1980s, Reagan administration economists took sharp issue with a report from the National Bureau of Economic Research that claimed that there had been two separate recessions in 1980 and 81. They argued that there had been only one long one, and that it was entirely Jimmy Carter's fault. And just this past year, President Clinton used the technical definition to rebut the charge that President Bush was inheriting a Clinton recession. If the economy doesn't get any worse, it's a safe bet the Republicans will be citing exactly the same definition when the midterm elections roll around in 2002. But in the end, we all have a stake in pretending that the vicissitudes of the business cycle can be reduced to precise definitions. As the stock charts head downwards, it's comforting to watch the economists on the business shows bandying definitions of market correction and expatiating about V-shaped recoveries. It's all reassuringly clinical, like listening to a clutch of cardiologists going over your EKG. It's striking how our economic talk has been purged of all the emotionally charged terms of earlier periods. People don't talk about financial panics anymore. Now we have major sell-offs. That suggests a more orderly retreat, even if the exchange floor is still strewn with bodies at the end of the day. And it'll be a cold day indeed before anybody on CNBC ever talks about hard times, a phrase that recalls the gaunt faces of the Dust Bowl farmers in the photographs of Walker Evans and Dorothea Lange. Economic downturn is a more congenial turn of phrase. It makes you think of out-of-work.comers networking at a south-of-market happy hour. Well, and why not? Since the days of the cavemen, we've been counting on the spells of the shamans to keep the bears away from our doors. And as we listen to the economists on CNBC, we can take heart in knowing that prosperity is just around the inflection point.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost Soldiers, a novel set in present-day Vietnam by James Webb, author of Fields of Fire. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Emmy Awards ceremony is this Sunday night. On the next Fresh Air, we meet two Emmy-nominated actresses. Jane Kaczmarek plays the mother on the Fox sitcom Malcolm in the Middle. Edie Falco plays Tony Soprano's wife in HBO's The Sopranos. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.